go through a few comments and then maybe I'll respond eventually. Mr. Singh.
Mr. Schmidt, just a quick comment and then a question. The comment is, I agree with the critique of so-called Indian media in Iraq, and just to maybe flush it out a bit more, which is that there is a media tool that is mainstream that would infuriate anybody who would watch it consistently, and that is, say, Al Jazeera or Al Arabiya. And if you just watch that, even I'm critical of the editorial lines and what have you, but the ability of those sources to show just how horrible it is, and they can't show the whole thing. And I think if you watch it consistently, and if you understood if you understood Arabic, you get even more, you can understand that anger. So in terms of getting images and getting the story is out, right? And one thing we could do is maybe make sure that those images get the text get translated and shown, because that's often the premise or pretense of doing Indian media, is that the story's not getting out. And the fact is it's there in a very mainstream way, but in Arab satellite networks, which are here, you can see them here. The question is, you said sort of twice about bringing it home and the terrain's here and upping the risk. It's a tough question to answer, I guess, and we get into things that we might not want to talk about. But I guess one way to talk about it would be, Vietnam and Iraq was compared. I'm critical of the comparisons, but there were political movements in here who tried to bring the struggle home. And many of us, we've read about it, or many of us work with those people who are doing massive jail time and what have you. So just throwing it on that in that way and asking, what do we mean by risk, and what do we learn from those movements that tried to bring the struggle home and said so, right? They said very much what you're saying, what others have said, which is our struggle is here. It's about imperialism. We're in the belly of the beast. Because if we're not going to discuss in these venues, where are we, and to what extent are we even capable of bringing this struggle home? What does that mean? I don't want to glorify anything at all and say it's about buildings coming down or what have you. But there is that lesson. There is that period of time, and it's within a lot of people's memory. So I'll just leave it at that. See what you have to say. What others have to say.
I was when you were talking about risk, and maybe I wasn't here right at the beginning, but international solidarity, as we're discussing it, is from purely political information sharing point of view. Is that what we're talking about, or because my background is public health and international health in particular, and so a lot of work that can be done is just basic. Figuring out what's going on with people's quality of life and trying to address some of that in a way that's not making things worse or not creating a dependency. So I was just wondering, when we talk about international solidarity, if we're just talking about the political information sharing type work.
I have a question I guess you're taking comments to answer later. And that's that, I totally understand being just, critical of anything and everything, because, the Middle East constantly presents this situation of it's just so fucked, and the reason why, you brought up analogies to imperial situations and anti-imperial situations, and it seems like there's some kind of deep irrationality, especially, with Iraq right now. What I perceive, and I wonder if you perceived it there, there's just such a willingness to genocide, And when you hear the Christian rhetoric here right now, it's that this is, 700 years old. This is going back to the Crusades, and that they're, that's part of what the whole contracting to the foreign, to bring Filipino and Indian workers in, that has to do with this, willingness to just kill everyone there. It's not like an imperial situation. The British could never kill everybody in India, or even a lot of the people in India. Kind of a very complex ecology and keeping that society in place but in a feudal state, but it seems like they're willing to kill everyone there, and that's where it's just all so much more complicated, and what do you do? Depleted uranium too ties into that.
Yeah. I guess I'll respond to two questions. And just maybe start with that. I mean, that's my feeling about it, right? It's mm-hmm. like there's this line in the Big Noise films, the new Fourth World War release, and it's actually in this section. It's a really beautiful sound poem or poem about Palestine, and you know, it's like occupation is always being afraid of the open sky, and the refrain is sort of like every day we die, and that's exactly like that's just yeah. there's no rational explanation for the level of death that
yeah.
seems to be acceptable to us in
mm-hmm.
Iraq, like and in that entire region. There's genuinely no rational explanation. It doesn't make sense, except in the most crass and brutal and disgusting expendability of human life, and lack of creativity in terms of political vision. So I don't, you know, I've been reading about like Rwanda and reading about Chechnya now, and just trying to read about all these different models of genocide, and the ways in which the international community has just kind of watched and been like, oh well, and it's hard to countenance that and feel a tremendous urgency about it, which I you know, seems sort of a moral duty at least, and then at the same time imagine building. This is to sort of segue into Jaggi's question, as sort of, you know, the long, slow work of building a truly anti-imperialist liberatory movement based here that could have, you know, genuine political links, not just friends in Sadr City, which is what I've now got, but like genuine political links with different movements that could actually, in a useful way, challenge that will the genocide again. And it's hard to imagine the 20 years that it seems to necessitate right now, because I see barely even the germs of that in North America among particularly among the predominantly white anti-war movement that was sort of supposed to fill that space around Iran. Jaggi, I was going to reference this really specifically, and I actually have sections of David Gilbert's new anthology, No Surrender, which is on sale in the sort of welcome area. I think it's really important, not that we rush headlong into creating armed struggle or sort of armed theater in North America right now, but I do think it's important to engage with the questions that David Gilbert and other people who were involved in the struggle in the late 70s framed really nicely and have framed even in even better ways since in their reflection on what happened during that struggle. He raises a lot of really good questions in that book and criticizes sort of their, you know, the haste with which they moved to the sorts of actions that they did, and the bombings of a whole range of buildings that to me are perfectly legitimate targets also, right? I mean, they did it without actually killing anybody except three of themselves. I think it's important to start talking and honoring that history really openly at this time, and to really engaging in it instead of sort of shying away from it as a question, only talking about it with, you know, one or two or three friends as though it will never ever happen. I don't think we need to repeat exactly what they did by any means, and I don't want to romanticize it in any way, but I feel like that history has sort of started and stopped and we've regressed, and those questions need to be engaged in a really open way. I also don't want to glorify risk. I don't think that anybody I met in Iraq was like, you know, woohoo, go home and get killed. And they certainly thought I should leave the country as soon as possible. They would have too if they could have. So I don't want to glorify that risk, but I think it is an important dilemma to grapple with the extreme inequality of the risks we take in any protest movement here. I don't really know exactly how to move forward, but those are the questions we need to deal with. There's something profoundly disturbing in New York City at the UFPJ march, having just talked to somebody in Sadr City where the tanks had been through again that night. You know, at 7 o'clock in the evening, we were sitting in Central Park after a nice day of walking in a circle and then taking the train to Central Park and kind of chilling out. It was hard to explain how that sort of really choreographed show of random people on the street really in any way addresses or challenges the system that has this tremendous world of genocide. So I don't know. And in terms of your question about how I was framing international solidarity, I was definitely talking about indie media because that was sort of a large component of what I was supposed to be doing. But I think that obviously solidarity work is much more multifaceted than that, can encompass all the things you were talking about. I do think, though, that the same relationships and the same quality of relationships need to be built for that to be done effectively, and so ultimately you're going to run into the same political conundrums in a lot of ways. And I also think that just in one of the things, this is sort of an aside, one of the things the entire experience made me reflect on a lot is the ways in which, as anarchists, we find it very easy to dismiss the work done by humanitarian organizations and the compromises they make. And that maybe we do that too quickly sometimes, and maybe there's some things we could learn from the caution that they use in assessing the political terrain they're going into.
I'm just wanting you to continue on with when you're talking about this sort of four different models. You were talking about quietism and then sort of blindly supporting whoever for the problem of waiting for your ideal movement. I'm just really trying to understand what you're saying because I think it's really crucial to sort of figure this out, and you've certainly done a lot of thinking on it. You sort of left us with the idea of sort of bringing it home, is what I'm trying to understand. And I don't see how that deals with the issue of accountability. I mean, there's a lot of work that's done in the United States against the war, but it's completely unaccountable. So, and you were talking about accountability before, like, how are you seeing those relationships built, and to whom do you think these movements ought to be accountable, and
right.
How do people start building those relationships?
Well, I think all four models are unsatisfactory on their own, and I think they just I sort of framed it that way because I think they point to different dilemmas that you face, and ultimately, I also think that for all that it's important to build a strong anti-authoritarian, anti-imperialist movement here, you know, to talk then about, you know, being in solidarity with people in Iraq, you need to have those links. Like you can't not be speaking to people and to movements there. I think the dilemmas I was trying to raise are then dilemmas that are going to appear in choosing in any different place, whether it's, you know, in Chiapas, in Palestine, and in Iraq. They're going to influence, how you think about them is going to influence who you decide to make those links to. And in Iraq, I go through phases of arguing for different things. So let's talk about Iraq, since that's what I can talk about. Some people in North America would say that we should be privileging making links with the Worker Communist Party of Iraq because they are the most left. They are not inside the interim government. They are clearly anti-occupation. And also, I think, because in some ways they were exiled. They suffered tremendous repression, both in Iran and then in Iraq. They suffered tremendous repression and have strong connections to North America. And so I think in some ways there's ways in which we can communicate with them better. Now, that raises the issue, though, do they, and this is to sort of reference Mark in the last panel, do they speak for Iraqi people? Well, they are incredibly, incredibly secularist to the point of almost being anti-Islam. And in a culture that is very Muslim, although there was this pre-war myth that Iraq was this very secular place because the regime purported to be sort of secular. It's a very religious and very culturally Muslim place. Is this the only group we want to ally ourselves with because they're kind of more like us, because they are the ultra-left in Iraq? That's a question. I don't know. So that's a sort of question. Does that...
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about aligning yourself with groups in the United States, or, I mean, just how to sort of...
What do you mean, which groups?
I don't... That's what, like, my question is, I mean, how are people going about figuring out, if you're doing solidarity work in the U.S., being accountable to the people that you're doing solidarity work in the name of?
Well, it wasn't clear to me from being in Baghdad that people are trying to figure that out very actively.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think there's, I mean, Iraq is hard to talk about in that light right now, because it's hard to imagine it being useful for many more sort of delegations to go through for 10 days and meet all the different political parties. But it's also true that if we're looking to support political parties, or a range of them, they do have a web presence. You know, it is often in Arabic, but it can be translated. There are international meetings where you can meet with people. Sistani's office, who's not a political party, but for example, at the same end, Supreme Council, Shiri, would have representatives in Europe, etc. The added complexity in a place like Iraq is that it's really hard to know who speaks for the Iraqi people, because nobody speaks for the Iraqi people. It's an incredibly divided society. And so how do you exercise solidarity in that context when, you know, also talking with an exile or a diaspora community, Iraqis, doesn't particularly help you overcome the fragmentation and the political debates. It doesn't make it any clearer. Yeah.
Well, this will be my last comment, because I feel like I'm taking up some space. Well, who speaks for any people, really? Like, you know, like, who speaks for the American people or the people of Boston? Or, you know, like, it, like, that's really a hard thing to, and that's been the hardest thing I've had with going into another country and trying to, like, figure out what the hell is going on enough to, like, even, like, come back and, like, share my experience in a way that I think is responsible. Because, like, even, like, the group who is hosting you, like, has what they want you to come out feeling and knowing about the situation. And, you know, I think, yeah, it's extremely hard. And I don't think there's anyone who's speaking for the people, per se. And it's, like, it's hard to, like, not have the history, especially if you don't have the language, like, how on earth you can get any sort of real, meaningful idea of what you're looking at.
Are there other?
I thought I'd just throw up, you know, this idea of the risk for us. And one of the dimensions that has been striking me for the last 20 years about the lessening of the risk and the comparison with Vietnam is, of course, that no one in America, none of us in America, risk going into the military. The draft is gone, which means that only poor people and people who really like the military join the military, which was this thing that a lot of people struggled for. But as far as I can see, the only thing it accomplished was lessening the risk for middle-class people. It massively cut back on the possibility of resistance within the military, which, you know, to my mind was by far, certainly was an important part of the resistance to the Vietnam War. In my mind, the most effective resistance on sort of, apart from the Vietnamese, happened within the military. It was the U.S. military refusing to actually participate in things. And now it's not, you know, it's not even on the surface a democratic military anymore, and that's the way we've shielded ourselves. I don't see that it's done the world a bit of good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that it's done the world a great deal of harm, in fact. And you know, and frankly, I think it was a cowardly mistake. Until we can abolish the military, I think we all ought to be in it. Yeah.
It was. I mean, it's. I mean, the cop. Just like two things real quick. It's like the idea of abolishing the draft is purely how the English system, that's why the English system doesn't have a draft, because it's like, if you abolish the draft, then you have to support the troops. I mean, it becomes this moral dilemma, and so what do? You know, if I stand up and say I'm anti-Iraq, then I'm anti the troops, you know, it's a perfect part of that particular machine, and I think what is really, really, I mean, becoming more and more apparent to me today, like, especially after hearing this comment, is like this total happened in Timor, but now it's like it's becoming like totally global annihilation of people. It's like whether I want to support which particular party in Iraq that I want choose to support doesn't really interest me today. What interests me is like this annihilation of all of these people in Iraq, which this machine is now doing. I mean, it's like, how do we really stop that machine, because it doesn't have a conscience anymore. It's like really stupid, and yet it's moving along really, really rapidly. I mean, it's the same in Palestine. And bringing back the drone would be a great way to start. I mean, I don't know. I'm really depressed from hearing all that. But
I'm glad I've been successful. Chuck, I know you have a comment. We're almost out of time. I just wanted to quickly respond. And David, you too? Okay, I was just going to quickly respond to sort of two things. I don't feel like as a movement here we need to get unduly caught up in which particular party in Iraq we need to support. Iraqis are going to have their own they're going to have to go through a civil war, I think. Whether or not the occupation is there and whether or not it withdraws, certainly not. You know, that specter of a civil war has been used by the U.S. to say that they should stay. I don't think that's the case at all. I'm not making that argument, but I do think that any future for Iraq is going to be very bloody because of the power struggles that are going to go on politically there. But that's for Iraqis to fight, not for us to fight. And things would be a lot better if the United States would pull out and pull out the CIA as well, you know, with all the trappings of their domination. But where it becomes important to recognize the political dimension of it is when you are trying to then make the direct relationships to people and to movements there that help you be accountable in your solidarity work here or in your movements here, right? And there, you can't just drop into Iraq and work with whoever, because 90% of the rest of the city will be like, you're working with a Ba'athist or you're working with the Communist Party. And whether it matters to us or not, it matters to other people, and it's seen as being supportive. It's seen as North American support for specific tendencies. And so in some ways, it's like this circular. You can't, in certain ways, escape those political dilemmas if you're committed to making the direct link. I'm not going to say anything else, but Chuck and David.
Okay. Do we have to? We only have to tell 5:30, or is it till 5:45?
I think we just have till 5:30.
I think it's 5:45.
Okay.
Okay. I wanted to pose a question. I've been having trouble understanding the idea of solidarity as I see the term used among activist circles. What it seems to imply is disinterested support for oppressed people, essentially. I'm doing solidarity activist work. And what's difficult for me to understand is actually supporting, say, from a center in North America, supporting a portion of an oppressed community or nationality group without having a political agenda. It seems to me that no matter what, you have to identify who you're going to support and for what reason and what kind of political result you want to bring about. And it just seems like that's inescapable. And my feeling, I'm not sure if it's inescapable, and I'd like to know if other people felt that those political questions were inescapable. My personal feeling is that becoming clear about what sort of political results you want to bring about is inescapable, and I frankly think it's kind of irresponsible to avoid that question, because I feel like it's incumbent upon people that are engaging in whatever arena to determine what sort of end they're trying to pursue. And it's a more responsibility to be clear about those and to articulate ends that are morally defensible. I'm frustrated with the anti-occupation movement for not being clear about its political aims. I feel like it's a form of cowardice. And I frankly think, I'll just say for the sake of being provocative, that it's very... It's very complicated. There are some occupations I would support, like the occupation of Nazi Germany by the American and other forces. I mean, that's an occupation I would support. I don't support the occupation of Iraq, but it's a difficult question I think we need to address. I'm not suggesting we should support the Iraqi occupation, but the political aims need to be addressed clearly. And I just wanted to say by way of contrast that the old communist, normally the old communists, the ones that typically thought that they were bringing the war home, had a they didn't support anti-imperialist movements in a disinterested way. Che Guevara went to Bolivia and got himself fucking blown up because he was trying to build a worldwide revolution, a Latin America-wide revolution. And he had naive fantasies about what the Bolivian peasantry were going to think. And as a result, he got shot. It was a foolhardy mission. Likewise, the Communist International had offices and agencies throughout the world through which they tried to foment revolution. Their aims, they had a plank. Lenin supported national self-determination. They had a plank where they supported it, but their aims were far from disinterested. Principally, all their work was organized around the political, foreign policy needs of the Soviet Union. So I'll shut up now, but I wanted to ask how people felt about that question, because my feeling is that it's important to determine what sort of aims we want to bring about.
I'm not going to respond to that, but
you come back to that.
I guess the response would be, I don't think we have to like it. We don't have to like anyone in Iraq to get our government the hell out of there and to try and stop the occupation. And to support the right to self-determination, it doesn't require that there be like anarchist collective that we're down with that have the right position on veganism or whatever. It's like,
I disagree.
I've been doing anti-war in Iraq work for the last year and a half, and I do agree that it's important to try and step up the movement on every level, whether it's candlelight vigils or militant direct action, particularly in the United States, which I think what happens to U.S. is one of the key things that can restrain or withdraw the occupation. I think it's a lot of very basic, like, how do we organize our society? How do we talk to people? And how do we engage in, information and political battle with the powers that be over what people think in this country? And a lot of it's just that, I've been trying to organize direct action and, not take the risks like the Weather Underground did, or the FBI organized similar actions, I think the lessons from those are, I would say that they were fundamentally counterproductive in terms of both movement building and building broad-based support. But like at the RNC, my anti-war group came out and, we could barely get anyone to sit down on 6th Avenue with us, and we all chickened out and nobody would even use the lockboxes we built. And that's sort of the stage we're at, never mind like doing anything more dramatic. But I guess I in the Bay Area, we've had one of the strongest direct action resistances to the war. And a lot of times it's been like 8 of us sitting around a room planning the next like shutdown of Bechtel or something like that. So a lot of it's not a mystery. It's like people like us going back to our communities and organizing groups that can do street heat and education, and then coordinating between the groups and a lot of that basic stuff. And I sort of feel like a blindfolded acupressurist. I'm convinced that if I keep like poking around in my organizing events, I'm gonna find some nerves of the people in my community that's gonna, and at certain points, people do wake up and get pissed off and things happen very dramatically. Or alternately, if we do some strategic thinking, in the Bay Area, we recognized a political opening the day after the war. So we spent 3 months stepping back and letting the other part of the anti-war movement do the day-to-day stuff, and we prepared for the day after the war and were able to create a vehicle through which 20,000 people shut down the city. So, a lot of us right now are involved in looking at a parallel political opening the day after the elections where, it's what we called the day after the war, a psychic break, where people's normal behavior is suspended and they're willing to do stuff like shut down our financial district. A lot of us think that, both framing it around the war, but also more broadly, the day after the election, people are going to be very upset. We'll probably be upset no matter what, but particularly if there's overt corruption again, like there was in Florida, that's a huge opening. If Bush is reelected and there's not some kind of massive dramatic response, the rest of the world will be absolutely certain that everyone in the U.S. is incredibly crazy and supports empire. And, you know, we'll all leave the country who live here and become depressed. And, you know. So, I guess my point is that a lot of it is just, you know, we have to get in there and actually do organizing and be creative and innovative and find new openings, but I'm not sure that there's small numbers of people doing, you know, very more intense movement, non-building actions is gonna help. I mean, I'm scratching my head as I think, so it's not like, you know, I have ideas and I'm continuing to do what I can, but it's not obvious. But we're also incredibly privileged, and that, I guess the last thing I'll say is, I think the hopeful thing is that the U.S. has politically failed, and that because of the people in Iraq and because of the stupidity of the U.S. occupation, that the United States and its empire have less legitimacy in the world than at any point in history. The level of opposition to the U.S. and its occupation is greater than at any point in history, and so we have an incredible global context, which is unprecedented. And all we have to do is, I mean, it's somewhat parallel to Seattle. It wasn't that we were particularly smart or clever or anything else. It's just like, wow, people in the U.S. actually stepped up and did something. And I feel like we're at another point where if people in the U.S. step up and do something, then the global context is incredible. And I do think what happens in Iraq is going to shape everything else that we work on. And that is a very central struggle of our movement. Anyway.
Yeah, I just want to say real quickly, I want to kind of build on David's point, because when people talk about, anyone hear me?
Yes.
Okay. When Dave was talking about, when people were talking about bringing the war home, for me, like, in thinking about that time in the 60s, it wasn't just the Brother Underground or the BLA, it was like, they couldn't, like, run their universities, you know, like the normal functioning, like during the Detroit Rebellion, like black people like took over the airport to prevent like troops to go to Vietnam or Germany or whatever. You know what I'm saying? Like shit like that happened. So for me it's much more about mass mobilizing, like they were saying in terms of like what happened in San Francisco. And I think that's an example that needs to be more broadcast and stuff like that in terms of like what goes on, because like I'm from New York and like no one on the left right now, particularly you mentioned the UFPJ, I'm not going to diss anybody, but the anti-war movement
as a whole. Go for it, I just dissed everyone.
Yeah, you know, like the anti-war movement as a whole has not really made a connection to Wall Street and the war in a really broad and popular way. And I think that's something I want to take home at the weekend or whatever. Another thing too is like, when you talk about solidarity and what Chuck mentioned in terms of politics, I want to also throw in the idea of imagined community, you know what I'm saying, and as part of it as well. Because I think that one thing that happened in, just to contrast Vietnam and Iraq again, was that in Vietnam, there was a sense of solidarity with the Vietnamese that was really based upon their imagination. Maybe not necessarily a political togetherness, but certainly there was a sense of right and wrong, and people connected Vietnam or what was going on here in terms of like, you know, racial class oppression here, you know, Muhammad Ali, you know, no Vietnam, you know, Vietnamese ever called me, you know, whatever. So I think that's important too in terms of Iraq, because for me, looking at it, at this point in society, particularly in the United States, people do not see Iraqis as human beings.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And I think that's one of the biggest things we have to deal with, and the fact that the first thing that happened post Saddam falling with the destruction of their national monuments, the destruction of the National Museum, the destruction of their cultural memory played a role, I think, somewhat in that sense of, you know, the Iraqis as not being a people. And I think the same way in terms of the attempts of internationals to get into Ramallah, during the stuff during Palestine, really kind of put Palestinians on the map in terms of, you know, Palestinians as the people. I think the same thing needs to go on in terms of Iraq as well. So I just want to throw that out as well.
We're almost out of time, and there's like a lot of questions.
I think we actually have until 6.
We're in 7.
Yeah, we do. Well, we'll sit here as long as we want. I just quickly want to say that there's something about, on the one hand, I agree with you about the sort of humanizing. Like, people have, Iraqis are totally dehumanized. I mean, it's clear in the way we deal with those casualties and the way we deal with American casualties. And, you know, at the same time, it drives me insane that we need to go to a place in order to humanize the Iraqis. Like, when I get there, I'm going to be dealing with humans. I don't have to humanize them. They are human. And if we can't explain that to our movements here...
No, I'm not to the movements. I'm saying to the...
No, well, if we can't explain that to just people here, with, even before we go there, there's something about it that's really problematic.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
It's like for people's dignity. But there are a bunch of other hands.
Yeah, I think the only thing, the only reason the war stopped in Vietnam was because of the draft. I mean, you suddenly had this block of people that, you know, under any kind of pretext thought that they were going to get their asses blown off. It was like they voted for whatever it could possibly be to stop the draft. This time, we don't have that anymore.
Well,
we've got to find an alternative to that.
This is a comment on bringing the war home. And I think that as long as we're in a global economy that runs on oil, and as long as we're in the global industrial economy, we're going to be going to war in the Middle East until we run out of oil, because that's what the system necessitates, like, period. And so I feel like the only real way to actually bring the war home and win anything is by building something else.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, it's really simplistic. But it's just like, I think that the idea of like fighting anything or going to blow up anything is really counterproductive, because it's busy collapsing, and like it is going to collapse anyway. And it's completely unsustainable. And that
perhaps we could make it go a little faster.
Yeah,
really.
I feel like it's going pretty fast. Maybe that's just me. I just think that that's not, or like we can argue with that if it works or it doesn't work, or if it builds movements or if it doesn't build movements. But I don't think it's a particularly effective way to make changes that need to happen. And just that it's totally incomprehensible to the majority of the North American population. You have absolutely no idea why you're not doing that or what you're doing. And like 40% of Americans think that Osama and Saddam are in cahoots. And like when you're dealing with that level of ignorance, your actions are just going to be so incomprehensible.
Panel's over, kids. Do people want to keep going for another 15 minutes?
We waited months for this.
Can I ask
a quick question? Because I respect your criticism of the independent media network, so I was just wondering if you could recommend or suggest one that you actually had a little bit of faith in or felt represented what's happening with that?
I should maybe clarify. I'm not anti-indie media as a whole, and I certainly respect as sort of individuals some of the people who went over, both as corporate reporters who are often very, very good at what they do, and I think sometimes we overlook that. Sometimes they actually do a better job than the independent reporters do, because the independent reporters don't have the $1,000 a week budget that it takes to do work in a place where you don't learn the language, first of all. But I'm criticizing that pattern of information flow and information control as being a reification of sort of a colonial extraction system. I'm not criticizing indie media as like indie media, the networks, or all the independent reporters who were there. Although I think that none of them were sort of being particularly accountable or particularly dialogical in terms of that. how they're functioning because they just didn't have the context to be accountable. In terms of sources, I think Jaggi's point earlier was well taken. I think the best sources of information about what's going on in the Middle East and about what's going on in Iraq are the Arabic news chains. And that even within them, it's worth watching a variety because LBC, which is the Lebanese channel, has access to the Shia areas, say, of Iraq, that Jazeera just doesn't have. The problem is that Jazeera has an English translation, like a translated website, and LBC, unfortunately for me, doesn't. So, but there, it's like any source of media. The more you can sort of take in and check against each other, the better a picture you're going to have. Sarah, and then there's a hand over there, and then Mark, and then Mary, and then you.
I agree with you. I don't think people should have to go to a place to be able to talk about it publicly and to try to further education in our communities, but I think it does give more credibility, if that's the word. I mean, you have direct experiences, you can tell stories that you saw with your own eyes. That being said, because I was going to ask this a while ago, and then you said, people going over there, people shouldn't have to go over there.
No, I just meant to humanize people.
Right, right.
I think people should go over.
Okay.
Well, not to Iraq. I don't know about Iraq. I just meant...
But getting back to what my actual question is I'm wondering, you've basically painted a glim picture of solidarity efforts that are happening. And I'm wondering if there are any organizations that do send over human rights observers that you know of. I mean, obviously, I think if you did know about them, tell us about them. But if you know of any that are credible, that would that do have connections with Iraqis. And also wondering what your collective does. The Iraqi, I can't remember.
The Iraq Solidarity Project.
Iraq Solidarity Project, what that is doing, and if you know of anyone, any groups that are trying to come up with solidarity projects that do actually send out human rights activists.
I'm going to quickly respond to that. I didn't really want to be, but it's a sort of fairly specific question. Right now in Iraq, the foreigners I know who were there are mostly either kidnapped, dead, or back home. And that's reality there right now, and that has a lot to do with the very complex political situation and why this solidarity work is really difficult to do on the ground right now. So it might be the case that this just is not the moment to be a foreigner in Iraq. This is a point at which there's so much CIA and Mossad there that people have every justification for assuming that that's who you are when you walk into the country. So there are, the Christian Peacemaker team still has a small team in Baghdad. They do very good work. It's easy to snare them because the word Christian is in their name, but they have tried in a very low-key way to make a lot of the better connections, the connections that have allowed them to be there at this point when other organizations pulled out in April. And they aren't showy and, whatever, but they've privileged those relationships. I don't know how long they're going to be able to stay at this point. And then, 3 weeks ago I would have said that Bridge to Baghdad, which is an Italian aid organization actually, but also is highly involved in the anti-war and anti-occupation movement in Italy, would be an organization that if you wanted to get involved or just have contact with other foreigners who were there, would be a really useful organization. But for all the fact that they had good contacts in a number in Basra and in Fallujah and all the different areas, their staff has now been kidnapped and is probably dead. So it's not clear in terms of making those links in Iraq. It feels in some ways like there maybe was a window last June and July when a lot of people in Iraq had a certain amount of hope in the occupation. I mean, nobody was naive really about the role the United States was going to play, but people didn't necessarily foresee that it would be as brutal and disgusting as this. So there's a window there. I think that window is closed now for a period of time. I'm just going around the circle in terms of hands that were up. So.
Well, my comment was just related to the bringing it home issue. I mean, we discussed tactics a bit, which I think is important, but I feel like the issue of self-interested solidarity, you know, some comments in the last panel were brought up about us doing community work, but I feel like the issue of power and what exactly we're bringing into our solidarity, it's crucial to talk about the solidarity that we're building around local issues, around our movements here, because people reference the Vietnam War. I mean, there was a civil rights movement, there were economic justice issues that also positioned the government in a scenario where they had to make some political adversaries by either funding housing or funding the war, and sometimes this dichotomy is set where we're looking at solidarity as just externally and what we can do, and rather than investigating really the movements that we're creating from the ground up. So that was pretty much, cause I just think that it's important for us to think about what we're bringing, and we're going to just be individual activists unless we're doing strong organizing here, and our solidarity is self-interest, but it comes from a mobilization here. So
just two things. First of all, I think there is some kind of rosy revisionist history of Vietnam going on here. I mean, I think it's important to keep in mind that, right, the U.S. was in Vietnam for 7 years with tens of thousands of dead Americans before we could put 100,000 people on the street, ever. There's been more people involved in the anti-Iraq war movement than there were ever involved in the anti-Vietnam war movement already. There have been whole cities shut down for a day. Detroit, with all respect, was not centrally around Vietnam. I mean, it was civil rights issues. I mean, I think this is kind of like unjustified whining. I mean, I think we've actually, if you compare this historically to any other war, we've got a hell of a lot of awareness in this country. We've got an incredibly broad group of people that are hostile about the war. There's a great deal more humanization of Iraqis going on than there were of Vietnamese in, say, 1962 or 63. I mean, you know, go read what people thought about Southeast Asians in 1963, for Christ's sake. I mean, okay, and so the second point is, I feel like there's a direction that this is going that you don't want to quite go to, so I'm just going to go there and see how you react. Because it seems to me it's the obvious conclusion of everything you're saying, which is solidarity work right now doesn't call for North Americans to go to Iraq. There's no good reason, with the possible exception of concrete humanitarian work, but there's no other good reason to be there. We've got plenty of information. We've got a perfectly obvious and clear goal, which is getting the American troops the hell out. And until we do that, and in terms of account, there's no issue of accountability. You know, call Iraq when we succeed. Hi, we got the troops out. You know, then we can worry about what else we ought to be doing with them. Then we can worry about all these other issues. But for now, why should we focus on anything other than getting the American troops the hell out? I just don't see that there's any other agenda that
I think, yeah, I don't mind if you go there for me. I mean, I haven't been able to because I desperately want to go back, and because at the same time as logically, I think that that is the ultimate conclusion. There's some old Christian anarchist thing in me that thinks that those personal relationships are worth building.
Yeah, but there's sometimes the things are fucked up enough you can't have.
I certainly wouldn't tell anybody to go there right now, and I think that is, you know, the ultimate conclusion that you would have to draw. So thank you for stating. I don't mind that at all. I'd tell anybody from the West not to go right now. I don't see what you would do there.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, and then
just two quick things. One on the, I don't think you're suggesting that we should go out and start blowing up places randomly.
Any
politically naive thing. But what you were suggesting, what you were asking us is, why are we not prepared to take the risks that the people who are fighting on our behalf in Iraq are taking, and the people who are under the occupation? Why are we privileging ourselves in this struggle? Because we certainly aren't being serious about building a movement which is going to radically transform things here at all. Just to paraphrase what you're saying, I think that's what we really need to get serious about building something which is not privileging, continuing to privilege ourselves. It's not about politically naive acts of tactically stupid things. But if something makes sense, which is highly risky for us, that we do consider doing that, and that's within the toolbox of what we're considering. On the question, I completely agree with you now. It's not the time to go there back. And for my own personal reasons, I just have to. But I do think I do think the question of maybe less accountability than long-term alliances, serious political alliances, is important. But I think those can be built in the region at this point, in Lebanon, in Egypt, in Syria, in Jordan. And there are long-term relationships that have been built up with Iraqis. There's a lot of traffic going inside and outside Iraq, and Turkey as well. And I think that's where we need to be building our alliances up.
I'm startled by how much you're saying that I have to read it. I'm like, I'm shocked. And so we can abolish the military, we should be in it. And like how obvious that is to me, and how just like, maybe, I mean, we're talking about having risk here at home. Like, what kind of risk do we face going to jail for the day or 3 days or whatever? Obviously, you know, many of us have been through it, and we came out just fine. It's not much of a risk. You know, we could agitate for a draft. Like, who's to say that? No, who's to say that isn't the most...
Congress is hot for it, people.
Yeah,
it's the most fair thing we could possibly do, is create stakeholders out of every person of the age and ability to fight. And maybe that's what we should start. I mean, I'm asking, give me one good reason why that's not what we should start doing.
It's wrong.
Because you go through training when you're in the army.
Yeah.
And then you...
I'm not saying we should join. I'm saying we should expose, we should discuss the injustice of not having conscription or a draft in this country, and just talk about that injustice in a very pointed manner daily. Like, that should be... I'm in my head right now, that seems like the thing to do. And I want somebody to tell me why it's not,
because
I don't want to do that.
It's working. I won't fly. So we'll go around this way, starting with Kazemi, and then come back to you. And we have 2 minutes. Thank you.
30 seconds. I just want to... I'm gonna let Leah take that question. But I'm going to respond to what... I'm sorry, Dr. Bruce Renner said.
John?
Because I think that... Really, like when you said, I got kind of a visceral reaction when you said that the reason the Vietnam War ended was because of one, you know, was because of the draft, you know, and like, a lot of historians link that as a major reason, but I think that in a certain sense that's kind of racist, because you really take away the autonomy and the movement of people of color to overthrow and militarily beat one of the greatest armies in the world. You know what I'm saying? And the Vietnamese kick their ass, but I'm not saying that historically, I'm just saying that because the same way that people think that, you know, it must have been, Bush must have knew about September 11, because there's no way that a bunch of Arabs could have hijacked a plane and flew into a building. It's just impossible. It had to be some sort of inside job. You know what I'm saying? So like, that line of reasoning is like, I'm just not feeling like that whole type of thing was saying that somehow because of the draft, the war ended. You know what I'm saying? There was much more mitigating factors than that. And I think that we need to explore that. Hit it.
All right. I was just
going to
say... This isn't about that. This is about... I just want to, pull out when you said, unless for humanitarian reasons. Like, there is no reason why, because we are anarchists, that we can't be involved with humanitarian organizations.
No,
there's no reason why we can't be doing health work, or we can't be doing, like... you know, sanitation work or other work like that. I don't think that's, like, there's a conflict in any way. And I haven't heard about health or, any of that all weekend. And so,
I didn't mean to imply there was.
Oh, no, I just wanted to, state that in, a very... I just wanted to reiterate it in a very, positive way. There's no reason why not.
Leah, David, over here, and then that's it.
I was just going to be really quick and say, so we put the draft back in against the desired effect, which is that everyone who gets drafted who doesn't want to go to war resists and refuses to go and dodges the draft, and then they eliminate the draft.
Just a positive note and shout out. I mean, U.S. Labor Against the War has been doing positive solidarity efforts trying to get the occupation repeal the anti-labor law. To me, that seems like the model. There's certain demands that come up from a lot of different sectors around elections or human rights issues. I mean, when the images of Abu Ghraib came out, we should have all been, that would have been an opening to be in the streets and to heighten that and organize people around it. And there's things like that pretty much every day now. So we don't have to necessarily go there, but there's a ton of things we can do to be in solidarity. The other thing I passed these around November 3rd. There are now 4 national networks who are calling for actions on November 3rd, no matter who wins. So that, I think, is the next major opening to try and do something, and particularly the major grassroots organizing going on in the United States right now is people trying to unelect Bush, and most of them don't like Kerry. So it's a huge opportunity for radicals to actually work side by side and to create vehicles for people to plug into after the cycle of the election is over.
What you said about like our what we should absolutely be doing is getting the complete withdrawal of the United States military Iraq immediately. Like, I kind of have questions about that. Like, and I definitely sounds imperialist, but like it's like, I mean, what's going to happen to the Iraqi people who aren't members of the resistance then?
Yeah.
I mean, and that's just the question. Like, and because humanitarian work needs to be done, absolutely. And I'm not so sure that pulling out immediately is the absolute wisest thing to do as far as human needs.
I agree with it. It's going to suck, but
yeah.
Not as bad as it'll suck if they stay.
I know major questions didn't get addressed, thinking of yours. I'm very aware of that, but thank you for coming.
Thank you.